Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So, friends, fans, bandmates, and family are mourning Chester Bennington of Linkin Park right now. He committed suicide on July 20th, and again, as with Chris Cornell, people are looking for answers that we're probably never going to find. But I think we got a real sense of how much he meant to his fans, his lyrics specifically, and what a big part he played in many millennials' formative musical experiences. And we have in the studio today Brittany Spanos and Corey Groh. Brittany is a longtime Linkin Park fan, apparently, or so I hear. And Corey is currently reporting a story for the next issue of Rolling Stone that will look into Chester's last days. And we're going to, in a little bit, play an interview with Don Gilmore, who produced Linkin Park's first two albums. And then also an interview with Machine Gun Kelly, the singer-rapper who was going to be opening up for Linkin Park on their huge tour that is now, of course, never happening. So, Brittany, tell me about becoming a Linkin Park fan as a kid, because I will say that one of the things that some music writers have seen in the last couple weeks is this huge disconnect between a sort of older generation of critics who really looked down on Linkin Park. They were, it's hard to emphasize how deeply uncool they were, even at the height of, or especially at the height of their success, versus people who were kids at the time who they were for whom they were a very important band. So tell me about your experience with them.
Yeah, I mean, Linkin Park definitely, they blew up sort of as the Lou Pearlman boy band era and Disney-fied like pop era was kind of dying down a little bit, and those pop stars were moving away. And so at the time when I got into Linkin Park, I was around like 9 or 10 the first time I listened to Linkin Park. And they were just, I mean, so different, and they were all over the radio. I mean, looking at the numbers now, how big they were at that time, they were outselling a lot of those boy bands and pop acts that I grew up listening to and really loved at that moment. And they were just a new type of outlet, as you know, you're going through puberty and you're like super angsty and you're listening to Linkin Park, and that was just like really fun to listen to. And everyone I knew in junior high was super into them, and they were just for us, it was a very universal appeal. There was no, you know, divisiveness to listening to Linkin Park when I was in junior high, as opposed to like boy bands that were more divisive, or Britney Spears. But Linkin Park, everyone loved in the end, and they loved Numb, and Collision Course was really popular. I know that was super divisive for a lot of critics, but that was really popular to a lot of kids my age. But yeah.
That's the Jay-Z album.
The Jay-Z album, yeah.
Yeah, so interestingly, the last time that I heard anything from that album was when I was riding in a car with Machine Gun Kelly when I was reporting my feature on him, and that's just part of his daily kind of intake of music, which is really interesting. And I think also if you listen to 21 Pilots, I think you really hear a lot of Linkin Park. It'll be interesting to see the continued reevaluation of them. How do you hear them now as an adult? Especially, is it really just Hybrid Theory and Meteora that were the essential albums, or do you see them as a band that continued to be important to their fans with new music following that?
For me personally, I was a huge fan of like Hybrid Theory, Meteora, Minutes to Midnight, and then I kind of fell off after that, and I've returned to a lot of those albums, like A Thousand Suns, which was I really enjoyed listening to over the weekend, that I hadn't really spent that much time with when it came out around 2010. But they definitely had a continued influence, and you can even see this past year they had a huge hit with Heavy featuring Ciara. The fact that that song grew as big as it did, Mike and Chester kind of moved on and did different things, and they worked with a lot of different artists, but their influence still remained. And I mean, it's pretty incredible that a band that in 2000 was selling, you know, like millions and millions of records was able to have a Billboard Hot 100 hit in 2017.
Hybrid Theory is really like their Appetite for Destruction, in the sense that it was, they didn't really need to make any more music after that, in the sense that they made that statement, and then a lot of things afterwards were either an elaboration on that statement or an attempt to escape that. In fact, yeah. I think Chester was complaining a little bit before his death about fans who wouldn't let go of that album, which is always the problem when you have a very career-defining album. But let's get into Chester himself. What do you think he meant to fans, Bernie?
I think he was a really great outlet for a lot of fans, especially for young fans. I mean, the music was just so raw and so visceral. And for me, I had never really heard anything like that. I mean, the way that he screamed, watching his performances, I was really obsessed with watching. I had never seen Linkin Park live, but I was obsessed with their Live in Texas concert film.
Huh.
And just like watching the way he performed, he had just like, you'd just see his veins popping out as he was like singing all these songs. And it was just like pure catharsis to listen to that. And I mean, especially at that moment with the way that rap was becoming more fused with rock and with pop and all of that, I think Linkin Park really found the sweet spot of what that can mean and what that was able to do.
If you had to pick one song to kind of showcase his vocals, what would that be?
I forever think that In the End is just, you really get that vulnerability when he does the breakdown. I think it's like the best way of the way him and Mike Shinoda played off each other. And you get that visceral anger and you get just like really beautiful singing voice.
So when I talked to Don Gilmore, which we'll hear in a bit, I pointed out that if you listen to the chorus of that song, I mean, that is a depressed person, that is a depressed mindset. Mm-hmm. And Don said that that wasn't really on his mind, Don again being the producer of that album, he wasn't really aware of that. And he also said that Mike Shinoda, the rapper, and much more, everyone played different roles in Linkin Park, mm-hmm. Mike Shinoda co-wrote a lot of the lyrics, even the parts that Chester sang.
Yeah.
So sometimes lyrics that people are attributing to Chester's mindset might not even have come from them.
For
which
sure.
Which is really interesting. Corey, how has your perspective on Chester changed in the kind of week of reporting? Because I know it can change rapidly once you get deep into reporting like this. So what's changed for you about the way you see him?
I always got the impression of Chester, and I interviewed him once maybe 9 years ago, that he was a very earnest and open type person. He never really hid himself. He never had a problem talking about the abuse he suffered as a child. He never had a problem talking about his drug dalliances, you know, which he'd given up kind of by the time that Linkin Park formed, but then he kind of fell back into them and relapsed. He was always very open, and that's something that I found while reporting the story, talking to people, that he was like that off stage too. And you know, sometimes, and I'm sure you know this, Brian, when we're interviewing people, you get the sense that you're getting the version of the person that they want you to see. And with Chester, I get the sense that he was that way kind of on and off. Like he didn't vary himself too much between the media Chester and the friend Chester. You know, I was talking to one of his friends that he'd known since he was 15 yesterday, and he was saying the same thing. He's saying that Chester didn't really change a whole lot. He, if anything, he just became a little more confident when Linkin Park got successful, and they remained friends throughout that. They were in a grunge band together called Grey Days, and he was a very consistent person, and I found that to be very interesting. He was a very upbeat person. He was a very positive person to most people, even up until his last few days when he was talking with people. It was always positive interactions and talking about the future and making plans. So it just, you know, adds a little bit more of the question mark to the things. You know, I think the fact that he was so open about the darkness gives you some insight as to, you know, there is this other side to him. He didn't project it all the time. He didn't present it all the time. And like Brittany was saying, like, you can hear it in the music, but maybe that was, you know, and that's something he told me once too, when I was going back through my interview with him, if he didn't have this place on stage, he would be totally going dark, is what he felt. And it was a catharsis to him. So it's interesting. It just leads to so much speculation that I don't necessarily feel comfortable going into, but just like, what happened? You know, just that's kind of what everybody's been saying. What happened?
His sort of origin story with Linkin Park has a real fairy tale aspect to it. He was like slugging away in Phoenix, Arizona, at various obscure bands, had almost quit a couple times, and then he literally got a phone call, and his wife had been saying, don't quit, someday you're going to get a phone call from LA. And then that phone call literally happened
on his birthday.
Yeah.
During a surprise party.
It literally happened that there was a band called Zero with an X, mm-hmm. which would then be Hybrid Theory and then be Linkin Park. Actually, the A&R guy, Jeff Blue, had heard like his demo and through his lawyer, not very like punk rock, but you know, that's not the kind of band they were. And this fully formed band with a rapper just needed the singer to pop in.
Well, their singer had quit. Their singer had left the band, and so Chester came in, and they needed someone to replace him and sing these songs that were on this demo. And what Jeff Blue sent them was two versions of the demo, one that had the versions with the original singer and one that was completely instrumental. And they said, show us what you got. You know, like, this is your chance. do it. And he ended up FedExing it right back to them, I think, a couple days later.
I mean, weirdly, it may seem, again, like kind of corporate or whatever, but, like, honestly, that's more or less how Eddie Vedder got his gig in Pearl Jam. Mm-hmm. You know, they had demos, except there wasn't, like, another dude who had sang the songs first, but Ed recorded vocals over instrumental versions of like what became songs on 10, and he had the they other people did that too. He just had the best version. So this is a thing that happens. And then he was thrown into this like existing band who were all best friends, and he had a whole life and a wife back in Phoenix and was struggling in LA to just kind of like exist.
And kids.
And yeah. And it's kind of a great story. And this is all, you know, in David Frick's really excellent cover story from early on. And another scene that stands out is there's a part where Chester's kind of celebrating what was then his newfound sobriety. And he's like, on the next album, I don't see what I'm going to have to bitch about because I'm so happy right now, which is, again, one of those moments that's super sad now. But Corey, what have you learned in your reporting that sheds any light on this or like gets at Chester's state of mind?
If anything, it's just more question marks than any, you know, like his friends all seem to say that he seemed sober, like when he was touring, like he hadn't been relapsing. He was in a good place. Robert DeLeo from Stone Temple Pilots, who I was talking to, who had just played with him in April with the cover band Kings of Chaos, was saying that they were making plans to grow old. They were joking about what brand of adult diapers they were going to wear when they got old. Matt Sorum, who was the drummer from Guns N' Roses, who also runs this Kings of Chaos band that I was talking about, was texting him the day before Chester killed himself, and they were talking about, let's do these shows coming up. They were making plans for shows. He seemed upbeat. You know, again, I was saying his friend from high school who they were going to be doing a reunion concert of Grey Days, the grunge band we were talking about from Phoenix. They were going to be doing it in, I think, Tempe. Like, they were going to be performing in Arizona in September, and they are reissuing their second album, and they've been working on it. They had producer Sylvia Massey working on this, who's, you know, best known for Tool. And Chester was approving mixes and saying, this sounds great. I'm so excited. I can't wait to play. And then everybody got the news. They got texts. They got phone calls. Some people didn't want to believe it was true. You know, Matt Sorum was telling me that I thought it was fake news. So
one of the things at least I only learned in the last few months was that Chester and Chris Cornell had been very close. I had no idea until, frankly, Chris's death. But that puts this into some strange context. And I mean, Chester sang at Chris's funeral. I believe he sang Hallelujah.
Yeah.
So it's messed up, man. I don't know what to say. What do you make of that?
I think that it's, I don't want to speculate that he had any, like he made this decision based on what happened with Chris Cornell. I think that that's wrong to do
no,
that.
No.
I think that he was close. I know that he was very depressed about it. People that I've spoken to have said that he was very down about it. Matt Sorum was trying to say, like, look, if you're feeling bad about anything, please call me, let's talk. And Chester just, you know, he didn't. He was very upset about it. Like, he was very close. Like, I believe, and, you know, I've seen this online. Again, I'm still fully fact-checking and researching this, but supposedly Chester was godfather to one of Chris's children. They were very, very close.
Mm. Brittany, what have you taken away from this sort of fan reaction to Chester's death?
I think that, I mean, obviously a lot of people were really blindsided, and because he was so open with a lot of the things he had been through, and for a lot of fans that was a really great way to kind of get through their own similar issues with mental illness, with trauma from abuse. I mean, having a figure like that sing and speak so openly about these things really made a safe space for a lot of Linkin Park fans and a lot of people who, you know, believed in what he was saying and everything he was doing. And so I think this was just a gut punch for a lot of people. And I mean, he was definitely someone that, you know, he wasn't too public figure-y also. So a lot of his life, to me, like, I never really read that much about his life and
right.
about his past and read interviews in passing. So, I mean, I, like, when I read the news, it was extremely shocking. For, you know, I only knew bits and pieces of his life and didn't really know a lot of his struggle with addiction. And I had read about the abuse a long time ago and didn't really know how much it had factored in. But I think a lot of people were just very, very blindsided.
I think now, especially when specifically Hybrid Theory and to a slightly lesser extent, Meteora, their pop hooks were just on point. Mm-hmm. They were a rock band of sorts who just did not shy away from enormous pop hooks that could stand up to, as you mentioned, the sort of Swedish penned pop hooks of the era, mm-hmm. which is really interesting and a reminder again of maybe what things with guitar in it have tended to shy away from. And one reason why they haven't been as big is just like you got to have those hooks. And I think because of a raucous tendency at the time, I think those very hooks were part of what made people scorn them. But now you look back and be like, man, there's some real craft going on there.
Yeah.
And I learned from Don Gilmore that, again, Shinoda actually would sometimes wrote the melodies too. And Don talks about that, which is really mm-hmm. interesting. So it was a real partnership. And I'm sure Mike Shinoda is completely devastated. It's hard to think about.
Yeah.
Corey Groh and Brittany Spanos, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. I close both locks below the window.
And now I'm about to play an interview with Don Gilmore, who produced Linkin Park's first two albums, Hybrid Theory and Meteora. And at the beginning of this interview, I asked Don about how Linkin Park's music first came to him. Let's hear from Don.
So I believe that you got a demo through your manager, and that was your first kind of introduction to Linkin Park, who may or may not have still been called Hybrid Theory at that point. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they were. They were called Hybrid Theory. Yeah, the name change came like after the record was done. But I got the demo from my manager, Bennett Kaufman. And, you know, at the time I had had a lot of success and my career was really on the rise. I'd done, I was just finishing Eve Six's second record. And then I did Good Charlotte's record right after Hybrid Theory. But I had success with Lit and I was kind of doing this sort of, you know, pop alternative punk kind of thing. And my manager said, look, this is a little different. You know, you might want to take a look at this. This might be a good thing for you. So I liked it. I thought it was okay. You know, it was good. And I thought it was interesting. I liked the electronic part of it. It didn't, you know, blow me over. And they really, you know, a lot of labels sort of passed on them. They didn't really, it wasn't like, you know, this is the greatest thing, let's sign it. You know, it was at the time when the rap rock thing was kind of happening. So, you know, they kind of rode that wave a little bit. Maybe they, you know, they were signing those types of bands and they kind of got in on that, I think.
But you weren't necessarily thrilled by what you heard, but at the same time intrigued enough that you wanted to move forward, obviously.
We had a meeting. I thought in the end was pretty complete. That song was pretty intact and it was very obvious, you know, this is a really good song. You know, I'm not really sure how it kind of fits, you know, in this kind of K-rock, rap rock thing that was going on, but I thought it was an excellent song. I went and saw them. They invited me to a rehearsal and, I heard Chester sing and I was just like, wow, is this the same guy on the demo? Because he was singing so passionately and aggressively that it was like, you know, this is really good. Okay. If we marry this with the demo and we maybe get a few more good songs, then we got something great.
Interesting. And then you kind of made your pitch to them, right? Because they were choosing a producer.
Yeah, you know, at that point it was like, you know, I called my manager and I said, yeah, let's really try to get this. And he, you know, you do the back and forth. Don loved it. You know, we do all that kind of stuff. You know, I maybe had another meeting with them and they chose me. It was and off we were.
What did you make of Chester personally? He was just really a kid at that point.
He's the kind of guy where you'd walk into a meeting or walk into the rehearsal room and he had a big smile on his face. And he was just kind of up for stuff. You know, he's kind of a, you know, energetic, fun guy. And working in the studio every day with him, he was wonderful. And, you know, he had some kind of issues going because he was new to the band. You know, he's from another state. He had his family in the other state. He's trying to do a great job with the record and integrate with the band. And, you know, they were really good to him and nice to him and they all got along and stuff. But I think he was a little frustrated just because he had this other life and he was trying to, like, you know, be in LA, focus hard, you know, and try to also be a good husband and deal with his other life, you know, while he was figuring out how he was going to, you know, live in LA or, you know, because at that time they had no money. They were just starting, you know. It's not like you get a record deal and you're successful. You have to make an incredible record, and then it's still a bit of a struggle to get there. But he had a lot on his shoulders, I think.
How privy were you to his sort of lyric writing process? Because I think, in case anyone wasn't clear on it, in the wake of his death, it became all too clear how much fans were relating to the things he talked about in his lyrics and how much what he expressed meant to them. So what was your knowledge of where that was coming from at the time and how he wrote them and what he was trying to express, all of that?
You know, Mike, you know, Shinoda worked on the lyrics as much or more. He's really a songwriter, big time. And in the studio, you know, like I said, In the End was pretty complete. Crawling was pretty complete. One Step Closer was written in the studio. The other songs were kind of all rewritten in the studio. And, you know, for me as a producer, you know, I see a weak point in a song or something that needs to be better. And, you know, I say, hey, look, can you guys rewrite this part? Or let's scratch everything and just rewrite this. Just give it a try. And there's always pushback with that. And in that first record, you know, it was tough a little bit, because for a producer, it's easier to do this with new bands. You know, an established band will be just like, get out of here, you're fired, you know, if you do that sort of thing.
Right, and that might be one reason why established bands, sometimes their albums get worse as time goes on, honestly.
That's probably right. But, you know, with these guys, I'd say, look, why don't we redo this? And they'd be like, well, you know, everybody, our fans love this. I'm like, we've got like 4 fans. You don't have any fans. You know, we're trying to break big. And so they started dabbling, and then all of a sudden, wow, okay, this is really good. Can you make it just a little bit better? Can you do this or this or this? And a lot of times at that point, working with artists, they've kind of, it's hard for them to go to that third place and fourth place and go back and do the next rewrite. They'll just give up because it's too hard. They're too used to the original. But these guys would start doing that, and all of a sudden, everything was getting so good, and they were delivering, and they were bringing in all this stuff. I say, go out and rewrite this. They come back in the studio, and they're going to be like, this is fucking amazing. So it worked with them. The kind of the coach-editor thing really worked with them.
At the same time, Chester said in later interviews that he did find it a little frustrating. Like, you were as much as you were driving him to make it better, it sounded like at that point you might have been driving him a little nuts. What do you remember about his pushback, which you kind of mentioned?
Yeah, of course. You know, people don't want to be at midnight rewriting lyrics when you've been working on it all day, you know, and you know, but like I said, I mean, they were delivering. So it's like, you know, I was just like, this is just too fun. You know, this is going to be a great record. So, you know, also there would be like, they'd look, Mike and Chester would look at each other and just laugh and go, God, this guy's nuts. And they'd just walk out of the room and like, you know, but then they'd come out back in with something great. So it was working, you know, and so I just kind of kept going, and, you know, the rest is history.
Who were Chester's sort of vocal heroes in your recollection?
That's tough. You know, I mean, he was the kind of guy, and you know, after I finished those records and they blew up, you know, and I'd go work with other artists, you know, everybody, you know, Chester was sort of like the gold standard. You know, I mean, all these singers would ask me questions, you know, what was he like? You know, they'd say, we met him once, and he was really cool. And I'm like, yeah, he is really cool. But they were very curious about his process, how he sang. Did he do vocal warm-ups? You know, what kind of vocal exercises? And Chester would laugh at people that did vocal exercises. He would just go in there and sing. I mean, he just had it. And he was always singing. I would tell other singers, I go, you know, one thing he did do that was a little different, he was kind of singing all the time. Hmm. You know, we'd go have lunch or something, and he'd be singing some funny thing. The voice was just like his thing. That's what he was.
Tell me about the split between Mike and Chester. How did they work out their sort of collaboration and how the singing worked with the rapping and just the general, which so defined the sound of the band?
They were really good working together on that first record. It was a real collaboration, and you know, the second record was maybe a little more Mike writing and stuff, but Chester's still collaborating a lot. But that's just kind of my feeling on it, that Chester and Mike worked great together, and it was like the three of us in the studio, really, after the tracks were all laid and stuff, and it was awesome. It was so good, so satisfying.
What do you remember about this song, In the End, and recording that one?
Like I said, that was pretty much together. It wasn't like, you know, we have to really tweak this and work it and stuff. They brought that in pretty much as is. There might have been a couple little things, but that was one of those cases where, okay, this is a great song. Let's just make it sound amazing. Honestly, it wasn't really my favorite song on the record. I mean, when we finished, you know, everybody's like, this is going to be the big hit and everything. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, I kind of see it, you know, I see Crawling and One Step Closer is more of a hit. But that was just my thing, and I'm glad it did work out really good.
When you have a chorus and you hear it, and, you know, I tried so hard and got so far, but in the end it doesn't even matter, that's, you know, I don't know if Mike or Chester wrote those lyrics, but that is a depressed person talking.
Yeah.
Did any of that strike you at the time? Because there is that cast, as we were kind of saying, to a number of the lyrics.
No, you know, one thing that you know, when we got in the studio, I'm trying to kind of figure out, okay, what is this thing? You know, we have, you know, this rapping thing that's a little not your standard kind of rapping. It's more poetic, and you know, we have this amazing singer, and we have like this great sound and this electronic thing and this rock. I'm just trying to kind of figure it out, and like you know what. And one, you know, and Mike and I would talk, and I'd be like, you know, I think he kind of, you know, I think even the band kind of wanted something, I've said this before, but something even kind of vocally more like Incubus from
right.
Chester, you know, something a little tamer, you know, and, you know, when he sang and we got that on tape, it was just like, dude, this is so fucking good. This is undeniable. So they saw that, but one thing that Mike and I, a common ground was Nine Inch Nails. It was like, okay, this is an artist. This is a sound that is very unique. It was different when it came out, and it broke, and it did well. So that was sort of like, okay, this is sort of like, you know, a path, sort of, you know, sonically that we could go down.
Crawling was one that was very close to Chester's heart. What do you remember about that one?
Again, so long ago, but you know, it was, I knew it was amazing. You know, I knew it was a great song, and it was just so unique, and yeah, I loved it. I thought that was going to be the giant single, and it was pretty darn big.
Did you have any personal conversations with Chester at those times? I mean, again, this is stuff we later learned, all these things about him, substance abuse, that he experienced physical abuse as a child. He had a rough time. How much of that stuff, if any, did he talk about with you?
I mean, honestly, he kind of talked about it with everybody, and that's another thing about this whole thing that's odd is because he, you know, he shared like his problems and stuff, and they, you know, the abuse thing that was pretty heavy, you know, but all of his other kind of stuff was just normal stuff, you know, like, you know, he's trying to figure out how to, you know, get his wife out here, and he's frustrated because she's saying, you know, you got to come home this weekend, and you know, the guy's sleeping on people's couches, and he doesn't, you know, it's just normal kind of stuff that we all go through. But obviously the abuse thing was just something I was just like, oh, wow. Okay. And I didn't really talk to him about it too much.
Mm. But it was something he just kind of casually brought up, I guess.
He did, yeah, and again, I don't know if it was necessarily just me and him in the room. It might have been like, you know, the whole band or a few of the guys, and we're eating lunch one day or something like that.
So, in a sense, you were surprised because this was someone who wasn't shy about sort of reaching out to people and telling them what was going on with it. He wasn't someone who kept everything bottled up, I guess, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. Yeah, he would freely you know, discuss stuff. He was an open book.
Did you have a sense, especially during that first album, that, oh, this guy's going to be a star, this is going to be the, you know, other singers are going to ask me about him? Was any of that evident to you as you were recording?
Yeah. You know, there was a little pushback on, like, the intensity of him singing, you know, from the band, and me saying, okay, listen to this. You know, people are going to freak out when they hear this. People are going to love this, you know, and there was a little bit of me selling the band on him doing that. He wanted to do it, but he, you know, he was new in the band. You know, he was trying to do a great job. You know, they were finding their sound. So it was a little contentious, you know, in that way when we were making the record, but we never specifically, again, you know, said, oh, we want to sound like this or that. We just kind of did what felt right.
Was it your impression that they were taken aback by the intensity of the singing? Because you said they wanted someone more in the vein of Incubus. They wanted sort of a smooth, I don't know if you want to say commercial, but sort of a smoother singer who would counteract the rapping. And they were like, oh, no, well, this guy's really intense. He's like a metal singer. We don't know about this. Is that kind of the thinking?
Yeah, I think that they did not want to be a metal band. You know, they did not want people to think they were a metal band. So, you know, as soon as they came in and listened to some of the tracks, they were like looking at each other like, this doesn't feel right. But it was like, guys, you know, this is so good. And I think that Chester even saying, yeah, this is what I want to do. I mean, they fully, you know, got on board. And that took the music and took the vibe to a whole other place that the band had never really been before. And that happened in the studio and you know, all to Chester's credit. I mean, like I said earlier, I didn't know he could do that, and he did that in the studio.
If there's one ingredient that kind of pushed Linkin Park into being a super commercial, super successful act, it probably was the enormous pop hooks that Chester sang. Was he always the melody writer of those hooks, or how did it work?
You know, Mike Shinoda probably 50% or even a little bit more, especially after the first record. The first record, it felt like Chester was very involved in all that stuff, very involved. And then Mike is sort of like this budding producer and songwriter. He's awesome, you know, so he's sort of maybe getting even more involved in all that stuff. But Chester still was very, very involved.
It's interesting. Did Mike then, have you heard demos where Mike like sang choruses and stuff? Is that out there somewhere?
No, not like that. Not like that. It would be kind of like, you know, they'd be working on a melody and Mike would kind of sing it, not on a mic. Chester would kind of take over and say, hey, maybe it could go up like this. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, that's good. That's awesome. You know, that sort of thing.
So what other memories stand out from your time with Chester?
You know, it's just, he was just such a sweet guy, you know, and he just felt like he, you know, I have other, you know, other people that would just met him once or something. He just felt like the guy was your friend. You know, he's just like a good dude. And he was funny, and he laughed. He loved to laugh, and he was an instant likable guy. It blows my mind that this happened. It's just, wow, it's terrible.
Have you had a chance to talk to anyone else who knew him and try to make any sense of this?
Not within the band, you know, but just, you know, friends outside of the band. And we haven't, as a society and our culture, we haven't dealt with this sort of thing that well. I don't think we really have a handle on these aspects of mental illness and depression. And hopefully, you know, we'll start looking at that more serious.
Sometimes when this happens with someone, you then look back and say, oh, this thing that happened now seems different to me. This thing that he said now seems different to me. Is there anything like that that kind of popped into your mind?
Not at all. Mm. Not at all. I mean, he wasn't a depressed guy. And I mean, it's a different topic, but Chris Cornell, I worked with him, not that guy. I mean, it was like, wow, Chris Cornell, that he did that. What? And then Chester, it's like, this is too weird. You know, this is, you know, Chris Cornell is a family man. He loved his kids, and it just doesn't make sense.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And And right now we're going to play an interview Corey Groh did with Machine Gun Kelly, the rapper who is supposed to be opening for Linkin Park on the tour they just had to cancel in the wake of Chester's death. Corey started by asking MGK what his reaction was, how he's been dealing with Chester's passing. Let's hear what he had to say.
You know, I was off and on between like wanting to continue to keep my commitment to the events that we had and wanting to cancel it and just curl up in a ball because, you know, I think like we felt defeated in so many ways, you know what I mean? Like we lost probably the biggest voice for my generation that I've ever been alive to see, you know, alive and aware of when they passed, you know, because like as influential as Kurt and Tupac were and Biggie were, like, you know, I wasn't all the way cognizant of their effect at the time. But like Chester was like, we had just shared the stage together 2 weeks ago. It's, you know, there's a lot of like a lot of regret in my system. And, you know, we were also about to go on a tour that I think this, you know, our generation hasn't seen anything like before. So, you know, there's a lot going on in my head. But, you know, I kept my commitments and I'm trying to just stay away from my own thoughts as much as possible and just keep it public. And I saw a bunch of pictures with Chester with fans, and it actually, like, after he passed, I saw pictures of him, and it actually like inspired me to want to like take pictures again with people and just give them that moment, because a lot of times I shy away from pictures and shit now, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of times I feel like people are doing it for the wrong reason, you know, just for the celebrity of it. But then when I saw Chester pass, I saw him with so many people and they were just smiling in all the pictures and they were so happy to have met him. And you know, it makes all the bullshit that you deal with in situations like that worth it when you have those couple people that really take those moments.
Yeah.
Cherish him forever. So that was cool.
It's true. Everything I've heard about Chester in the last few days is just how open and earnest and like you said, just with his fans, dedicated he was, you know. It seemed like he was totally this open person.
I mean, you know, I saw nothing in his face that reflected what happened. So yeah, I don't know if I was just always around for the good times with Chester or what, but.
Well, that's the other thing. I've talked to a lot of people that he's played with over, like, in recent months and stuff like that, too, and they say the same thing, that, you know, people were texting him the day before, and he was, like, planning shows with them, like the Kings of Chaos, that group that he had. Like, he was making plans.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about the last time you saw him, because you said it was just a couple weeks ago.
It's funny. The last time I saw him was in Poland. We were we had did a couple shows together in Europe that our management had put together just because we wanted to like warm up for our US run. And I remember they were like, come out for Bleed It Out tonight and end the show with us, and I was like, oh fuck yeah. And I went out, did the song with them, and after I did my verse, it's so funny, I looked over and like just so like Chester's, so I'm still so starstruck by him and Mike that like after my verse was done, I was like, oh well, I should probably just leave the stage, you know what I mean? Like it's the finale of the show. It's not my show, so it, you know, my moment's done. Like I should just leave. And it's so fucking crazy because I got an email from Mike after the show, and the email said, "Yo, Chester and the boys want you to stay out for the whole finale next time." And it's just fucked up because there was no next time. So
yeah, that would have had to have felt.
Last time, legitimately, the last time I saw Chester, he was looking side stage and giving me the what the fuck face, like you should have stayed out here. And that was like, that's how I want to remember. That was the fucking coolest shit ever, man. I wish that I would have had another chance to stay out there.
So you're listening to an interview that Rolling Stone's Corey Groh just did with Machine Gun Kelly, who is supposed to be opening for Linkin Park on their now-canceled tour. In this next segment, Corey asks MGK just about what was supposed to happen on this tour that will now never happen. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think, like, one, we were going to be, like, a really, you know, we were talking about how we love and what's missing in tours is, like, this camaraderie between, you know, the acts on the bill and just want, you know, we were, you know, going to be doing a lot of like Facebook Lives together and like just, you know, kind of, you know, a lot, like I'm very active with, you know, video vlogs, and we have a very popular YouTube channel. We use that through. We were kind of all like planning just like skits and just like fun shit that I haven't seen since like, you know, maybe like Blink 182 days, you know what I mean? When they were doing those DVDs, like the Urethra Chronicles, like just fun, funny shit. Cause Chester's fucking hilarious. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like we, you know, so we were dabbling with that before he even left. And like, you know, and then me and Chester were talking about doing an epic cover at the end of the show. And, you know, he was talking Metallica. I was talking, you know, we were going back and forth on, you know, what cover we were going to do. And that was going to be a surprise for the new U.S. dates. So there, I mean, it was just, I don't know, man. And like, and plus there was like, there's like the buzz around us right now because, you know, this album and the way we did Europe, it just like, there's just like a lot of momentum, and it just felt like it was just going to be like every fan that was there was just going to get the most worth it, you know, like the most you could get out of your fucking money spent. You're going to get to see, you know, like your childhood favorite band who still sound better than fucking ever and larger than life, and you get to see like Machine Gun Kelly's fucking like breakout, like fucking big first fucking real big venue tour, you know what I mean? And like, the stage plot we had was so epic, and you know the way we do Bleed It Out is really fucking cool. So,
wow.
I don't know. I mean, you're just sitting here talking. I'm obviously like just living in that still, and I need to not. But just, it was weird. We had a lot of big things planned.
What Metallica song did he want to do?
Oh my god, I'm so fucking mad. I don't remember what fucking song he wanted to do. Dude, I won't forget, and it was me yesterday, and we were just sitting there, like, not even arguing, but just, like, throwing out so many different random cover ideas, but he was super passionate about, like, no, it'd be so cool if we did, like, this, and, like, you could do this, and, you know, there's this, and, like, you know, there's like, other people coming on the tour as well, like, in different regions, so, like, you know, we were trying to involve, like, everybody in it, and I don't know, man, he was just ambitious, and he looked like he was full of like fucking new ideas. It was crazy. Like, he's such a legend and done so much already. I couldn't believe how like giddy he was about like these new ideas.
How would you describe his personality? It sounds like you had a lot of time with him here and there.
I mean, not even in a corny way or anything, but just like sweetheart, I guess. Like, he has this really like soft fucking like talking voice. And you know, he like looks you in the eyes when he speaks to you. You know, it's just certain qualities that you notice in people because they are so rare. But yeah, just very, very soft, but like knew what he wanted to say. It was really cool. Because then when he went on stage, he's so goddamn loud.
Right.
So I guess that's why I point that out. Because when you do talk to him, he doesn't talk like, you know, there's two people in that guy for sure.
Everybody I've talked to so far as I've been doing this is just saying that he seemed to be in a really good, you know, frame of mind the last few weeks, last few months, that this was just a total surprise. Was that your impression from talking with him?
Yes, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We thought it was fake news, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw your tweet saying.
We thought it was fake news, you know. I there's no way. I was talking to Mike that morning.
Wow.
We were making our show tracks for the Linkin Park set. We had just shipped off all our production to Boston for the first day. Like, there's no fucking way. It didn't make any sense. I was just, Mike had just sent me like a song that he and I had did together.
How did you find out it was real?
Sorry.
Or when did you find out it was real?
When my phone started blowing up, and like I got one call from someone in my management who was just like, who called but didn't say anything, and like when they didn't say anything, I like knew what it was, and I was with my kid actually, and like a lot of times you like shield weird moments from your kid because they're just not ready for that. There was no hiding that one. I fucking lost my shit.
Yeah.
There was a lot that goes into accepting something like that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, fuck, man, I can't imagine how, like, Mike feels, dude.
So you've been listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week at 1 p.m. on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to leave us a nice review on iTunes or wherever else you can. And we'll see you next week.